listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, it's the Friday News Roundup. This week, 1A looks at the challenges ahead at the border. What impact will the end of Title 42 have locally and nationally? That story and more today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, Wisconsin's young voter turnout led the nation in last November's midterm elections. New data from the U.S. Census Bureau shows that nearly half of Wisconsin voters aged 18 to 24 cast a ballot. Some recent statewide elections have been decided by less than 30,000 votes, so that youth demographic has the potential to swing results one way or another. But what caused Wisconsin's massive youth turnout in November? What, if anything, are we doing differently than other states? Our guests today will help break it down for us. Amanjot Kaur is a freshman at UW-Madison. She's a co-lead intern with the Badgers Vote Initiative through the Morgridge Center for Public Service and an intern with the League of Women Voters of Wisconsin. I talked to her earlier today. Amanjot, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me here.
Well, we've got this data showing Wisconsin youth voter turnout a high in November for sure. It looks like it was pretty high in April as well. Does that match up with what you saw in person on the UW-Madison campus?
Yes, we have had a surprising turnout both in the midterms and also in our April 4th election, the general in the spring. We were just talking about this a few days ago. One of the co-directors of the Badgers Vote Coalition was sending us all of this data about how we had like 80% plus turnout during the midterm elections, which is very like historic for our campus. Usually we get somewhere closer to 75, 76. So we saw a bump from what we're used to, which was really amazing.
What is it, do you think, that's getting college students to turn out over this last couple of elections?
I think part of it is that we have, on this campus at least, made voting a lot easier for students, a lot more accessible. A lot more students are more knowledgeable on how the process of voting actually goes, like when to register and what IDs to bring. And also more people are becoming more and more aware of what's on the ballot, who their candidates are, what the issues are that people are passionate about. I think there have been a lot of important issues over the last few years that have really been bringing people out. I know in April 4th, for example, the Wisconsin Supreme Court election was really, really invigorating for students. And it got a lot of students to turn out because they were very passionate, regardless of which side they were on about a lot of issues like redistricting and abortion and the like that were going to be impacted by the Supreme Court. And I think in the fall, a lot of the turnout and excitement around the midterms was a lot of young people who are finally now able to vote, getting to vote in this really large election for these really large seats that have a lot of impact on their lives.
Now, it's been a day or two since I was college age, but back then there were initiatives to get younger people to vote, rock the vote and things like that. They didn't seem to work very well. Is there something you think about the current generation of new voters that is looking at the world differently than maybe the past couple generations?
That's an interesting question, because I think a lot of our generation is very politically mobilized in a way that I'm not sure other generations or previous generation necessarily was. I think there's been so much happening in the United States politically, and that people are very excited by what's going on, and they have a lot of thoughts and opinions. And young people in particular have grown up through a lot of very turbulent things in the United States, like the recession in 2008 and the presidencies that have occurred during our lifetimes, and like the COVID pandemic and everything that's followed COVID. I think that a lot of us are very aware of all of these different issues going on because we've kind of lived through the turbulence, and that's mobilized students in a way that maybe didn't exist for previous generations. I also think that a large difference for us is social media and the internet. I know in particular for Badgers Vote, this has been a really important tool, is that we have seen the most voter education effort success when we use social media and the internet. We get tens of thousands of views on some of our election videos, which is just shocking. And a lot of students learn about what is going on in their local areas and their local elections through our social media, through our Instagram, through our reels and our video postings and our collaborations with other social media people like Charlie Behrens, for example. A lot of those social media, like internet efforts, seem to really target students and younger generations well, because that's kind of what they're all on. They're all on their phones. So like having the ability to put that information where people are always putting their eyes towards makes it a lot easier to grab someone's attention and get them to care about voting and learn more about voting processes.
Now, if someone else is out there, either on another campus or in a community where they want to get younger people to vote, college students or non-college students, based on your experience with these elections over the last year or so, what would you suggest to them as starting points?
I think there are three things I would suggest. The first would be to make sure that the students and the young people in their area are educated on the voting process. I think a lot of people are intimidated as first-time voters. There's all these different steps you have to navigate. And I think voter education and civic education is a really large part of getting people to turn out to vote, helping them know when to register, helping them know what their voter ID is if you live in a state where voter IDs are a thing. Like in Wisconsin, for example, we have at UW-Madison campus a lot of out-of-state students that aren't used to their state offering same-day voter registration. So that's one of the things that we tell people and help them navigate is how to register the day of the election. And voter IDs are also a thing that a lot of students aren't used to. So helping them navigate what is and is not a voter ID has also been a large part of our efforts to get people to vote. So voter education would probably be the first thing. The other thing that I would promote, or like the second thing, would probably be to listen and learn what it is that young people are passionate about. I've heard all sorts of issues throughout the year, and I think that learning what the candidates have to say on issues that young people really care about can really help them to understand why they should participate in an election. One of our other Badgers Vote interns, she went to a bunch of fraternities and sororities once to get students registered to vote. And she was talking about local elections, like the mayor and alderperson. And they were asking why they should care about older people. And she told them that they should care about older people because older people control their liquor licenses for all of the local bars and places that sell alcohol. So that got them mobilized to want to vote for older people. Knowing, I guess, the audience you're speaking to and what they care about can help get them more interested in why voting and elections matter.
Amanjot, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, of course. Thank you so much for inviting me to do this and for talking about these issues. I think they're super important.
Amanjot Kaur is co-lead intern with the Badgers Vote Initiative at UW-Madison and an intern with the League of Women Voters. She was with us today to share her experience as a UW-Madison student helping organize youth voting on campus. Wisconsin wasn't the only place that's seen a rise in youth voting in recent elections. The trend carried through in many states around the country, leading political organizers on all points of the spectrum to focus their efforts more specifically on the newest generation of voters. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you make of this record youth voter turnout? Did it surprise you? Why or why not? And are we talking about you? Are you one of the younger people who voted, maybe for the first time in November or April here in Wisconsin? Let us know what led you to the polls at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Abby Kisa is the Deputy Director of the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement at Tufts University in Massachusetts. She researches youth civic and political engagement. Abby, welcome to Central Time.
Hello. Thank you so much.
How widespread are you seeing this increase of youth voter turnout in our recent elections?
Youth turnout has been historically high in recent elections. In the 2018 election, we saw young people vote at the highest rate in a midterm election since the early 70s, since the voting age was lowered. And it doubled compared to the 2014 election. And then in the 2020 presidential election, youth voter turnout jumped 10 points. And that really shows that young people are interested and will participate when they're given pathways to engagement. But there's still a lot of work to do to broaden the electorate. And one of the things that I think is really clear from this data is that young people's voter turnout is not a matter of apathy. It's a matter of access and opportunity. And so we really have to ask, are communities and institutions equitably preparing and engaging all young people to vote? And when you look across different states, we see huge differences. The census data that you were just talking about shows just dramatic differences between states, you know, over 20 point differences. And so as we continue to talk about this, we really have to think about it on a more local level and trying to understand what are the access and supports that young people have.
One thing I wonder about when it comes to different levels, how about young college students versus young non-college students? Do we see a gap there when it comes to turnout?
You know, this is one of the things that the census data allows us to do is go back and look at trends over time, over the last 50 years. And this difference in education, the relationship between education and voter turnout, is something that has sustained across all of those decades for which we have this census data for 18 to 29 year olds. And one of the things that we think it comes down to is that young people who have experiences with higher education institutions are exposed to things like the Badgers Vote Coalition that the student Amanjit was just talking about. And they're exposed to people who are really actively involved in politics in some way and learning some of the skills that really lend themselves to participating. And so that matters a great deal. And one of the things that we've seen over time is that young people who are not on college campuses get a lot less support and a lot less attention, for example, from political campaigns, right? Political campaigns often just go to college campuses. And so this is one of the areas where communities have a lot to do to be more inclusive in how we think about elections.
Yeah, let's imagine a town or city without a big college campus on it. Do you have thoughts on what a community could do to say, hey, we've got a lot of young voters here, we'd love to see them participate. How do they open that door?
Absolutely. This is a great question. And I think it starts with young people in that community. And this is one of the core parts of what we call a sort of circle growing voters approach. Not only is it rooted in understanding and working with young people in a community, but it starts well before a young person reaches 18. Because by a young person reaching 18 years old, there's plenty of opportunity for that young person to develop, you know, a sense of the sense that politics isn't for them or that they're not welcome in it. And so by starting to reach young people before they reach 18, not only are we reaching them, you know, when many are still in the K-12 institute, K-12 school districts, but we're also reaching young people at a moment when they're building their sense for who they, you know, continuing to build their sense for who they are. And that's really when civic habits are forming. Because voting is a habit. We call it a civic habit. And once a young person starts to vote, the more likely that they are to continue to vote. So two really core things about for a community is understanding that we have to start these conversations with young people before they reach 18. We have to include young people in a wide range of young people, not just the young people who are opting into the, you know, high school Republicans and high school Democrats. And we have to recognize that it might take a lot, many stakeholders to make sure that there aren't young people falling through the cracks. And what I mean by that is we have to have multiple pathways for young people to find out about how to participate in elections. And, you know, like Amanjit was just talking about, they were talking to sororities and fraternities as well as on social media. They had multiple strategies that they were using. And that's the same for an entire community. We need to be, you know, talking about this in schools. We need political campaigns to be thinking about it. Our election administrators have to be thinking about the wide diversity of young people. And there's lots that parents and families can do as well, just to talk about these issues and build the awareness about how to vote and that an election is coming.
Talking to Abby Kisa, civic engagement researcher at Tufts University, looking at a boost in youth voter turnout, young voter turnout in last November's elections here in Wisconsin. According to new census data, Wisconsin number one in the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about youth voting trends? What do you think is driving younger people to the polls? If we're talking about you, we would love to hear from you. Join in at 800-642-1234. 1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Abby Kisa, civic learning and engagement researcher at Tufts University, looking at Wisconsin's strong youth voter turnout last November, according to new census numbers. Looks like it was high in April as well in the Supreme Court election. looking at what we can expect from young voters in future elections, too. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. There's a perception anyway that younger voters tend to vote for Democrats in elections. Former Wisconsin Governor Republican Scott Walker is now president of the conservative youth organization Young America's Foundation. He did an interview with Fox News right after our April midterm elections about the impact of youth voters and the need, he says, for conservatives to do better.
We don't yet know the numbers by age, but we do know that Dane County, which is where the University of Wisconsin's flagship campus is at, about 50,000 students are enrolled there. Dane County cast more ballots in the race for the Supreme Court than the largest county in the state, Milwaukee County. And in Dane County, 82% of those votes went for the radical. And so unless we turn young people around, and it's not as simple as one campaign ad or some sort of a coalition, this is years of liberal indoctrination coming home to roost, and we've got to turn it around if we're going to win again.
Can you talk about the partisan lean, Abby, on youth voting? And it gets controversial how youth vote outreach happens, too.
Yeah, thanks for this question, Rob. I mean, one of the things that we really need to differentiate between is what happens nationally and what happens in various states and communities. Because, you know, while it is a national trend that young people are favoring Democrats and more liberal candidates, this isn't the case everywhere, and it hasn't always been this way. And so one of the things that we've seen, for example, is that in the 2016 election and the 2020 elections, there's actually a handful of states, six or seven states, where then candidate and you know, also President Trump won young voters in a handful of states. And so, you know, we really need to bring more nuance to these conversations about young people, or we do them a disservice by just sort of stereotyping them. And this, you know, matters for how political campaigns think about young people, because if you're in a community that, if you're in a community and thinking about young people, then have conversations with those young people instead of stereotyping them and assuming what they think. And so this is just exemplary, I think, of the need for campaigns to spend more time listening to and speaking with young people. And we've seen in our data that that can have a strong correlation to young people actually turning out when political campaigns are actually speaking with them and reaching out to them. Unfortunately, we've certainly seen Republican candidates and the Republican Party do that less with younger voters recently than the Democratic Party. And so that is one thing that, you know, has been consistent over the past several cycles.
Let's bring on a caller now. Kay is with us in Madison. Kay, hello.
Yes, hi. Thanks so much for this topic. I've been kind of working on it for 30 years. I'm a UW Poli Sci graduate, and I, on the information issue, I'm concerned about the lack of education on government in our schools. The last statistics, which is fairly recent, I know 19 states have no civics courses. I quote a 2005 poll that I did in one of my works that more students could quote the names of the Three Stooges than our three branches of government. The neo-Confederates have finally won about 5 years ago. They convinced a national poll that slavery had nothing to do with the war. So obviously there's the false information and populist information versus our educational system. And which I see, I understand perfectly about the local need for young people, but to my mind, our education systems are not doing enough.
Okay, thanks a lot for the call. Abby, your thoughts on civic and government education and Kay's concerns about misinformation as well.
Thank you so much for this question, Kay. This is an absolutely important area for us to think about. And I think it has a very local lens as well. Because one of the things that we've seen in our work is that, you know, in addition to the fact that opportunities to talk about elections and voting in a school context in nonpartisan ways, they're distributed really unequally amongst young people. So young people in AP classes are much more likely to have that opportunity, but young people who are on the, you know, kind of the regular track are less likely to. And young people who are on a different track than that are even less likely to. And so that's one of the things that I think we need to be talking about is how can we make sure that all young people in K-12 have the opportunity to talk about and learn about some of these basic workings of democracy. And for us, one of the things that we have been a part of, it's called the Educating for American Democracy Initiative, has really been focusing on some of the ways in which schools can support teachers, and that teachers can really be a leader in these efforts locally. Because one of the things that we've seen is that teachers who have support are much more likely to use the research-based promising practices for teaching civic education, right? And we want teachers to embrace those research-based practices. And so this is a really big thing that communities can do to come and rally support for teachers to be able to do this work. So Cabe really brings up an important point, and we need to think about equity and distribution of young people's exposure to this, as well as what can be done to support teachers and schools to be able to do this work.
Okay, thanks for that call. And Abby, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Abby Kisa, Deputy Director of the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement at Tufts University, where she researches youth, civic, and political engagement. She is with us today to talk about rising youth voter turnout in Wisconsin in particular and beyond. Earlier, we heard from UW-Madison freshman Amanjot Kaur about her work as an intern with the Badgers Vote Initiative and the League of Women Voters of Wisconsin. Still time for you to share your thoughts on this big uptick in young people voting here in Wisconsin, especially Wisconsin, but elsewhere in the country. You could email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. If you are a younger voter yourself, love to hear from you about what your first voting experience was like, what got you to the polls. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, it's college graduation season and high schools are close behind. What does the job market look like in Wisconsin for graduates at all levels? We'll take a look and you can join in with your questions and experiences. And the race for space started as a contest between countries. In the last couple decades, private businesses have taken center stage. Look behind the scenes of businesses racing for orbit. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Food Friday, a cookbook author tells us about heritage grains and why they can be a great choice for the environment and for our cooking. First, we're talking about menopause and why we don't always talk about menopause. It's incredibly common for about half the population of humanity, and yet menopause remains often a taboo topic. Here's English comedian Bridget Christie.
I'm hot because I have a very rare medical condition. Called the menopause. Yes, it's only about one in one women who experience it, so it's a little bit under the radar at the moment. Nobody really knows anything about it because it's not something that happens to men, so there's no data or research.
That can have serious consequences. A Yale Medical School study of 500,000 women found that 75% who sought medical care for menopause symptoms got no treatment at all. And menopause is more than just hot flashes and mood swings. During menopause, a woman's risk of cardiovascular disease, osteoporosis, and other serious conditions goes up. Why don't we talk more openly about this big life transition, which affects, again, half the population? You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're there now or have been, what do you wish people had told you about menopause before you experienced it? Are there things you feel like your doctor didn't tell you about? Why do you think it's something that we don't talk about so much? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jancy Dunn is a journalist and author. Her most recent book is Hot and Bothered, What No One Tells You About Menopause and How to Feel Like Yourself Again. Jancy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Well, you quoted that comedy bit from Bridget Christie in your book, but you also lived the reality as you hit perimenopause and then menopause. What were you thinking about why no one had told you about this stuff leading up to it?
There's a couple of different reasons. One, as you mentioned, that menopause training in medical school, it's only taught for an average of 1 hour. So people don't get information from doctors. It's just not out there in the culture because of, you know, sexism, ageism, you know, women's health seems to fall off a cliff after they have babies. And they're just, you know, people are just hungry for information. And I myself, I wrote about health for 20 years. I'm a health writer, and I did not know that perimenopause, peri means around, it's the years leading up to menopause, that it occurs most commonly in women in their 40s. Well, when I was 45 and I started getting symptoms, when I skipped periods, when I started getting hot flashes, for some, I thought I was pregnant. I had a toddler at the time. And I remember shaking my poor husband awake because I realized, wow, it's been a couple of months. And I said, Tom, I think I'm pregnant. And we had this long, involved chat about how, if I was to have another baby, we had always just planned for one, how we were going to afford it and the emotional repercussions of it. It was intense. And then I finally realized later when I connected the dots, oh, I wasn't pregnant. I was in perimenopause. But I had a toddler. I was taking my kid to, you know, Elmo-themed birthday parties. I just wasn't thinking that it was happening to me so early, but that's actually the norm.
Right. That, you write, is a common experience. Another common experience is some doctors you went to talk about a perimenopause symptoms told you, maybe it's just stress or something like that. How long did it take you and other women you talked about to get doctors to say, oh, yeah, perimenopause, menopause, let's tackle those symptoms head on?
Yes, a lot of doctors, and I'm not knocking doctors. Again, they don't get much training, but they sometimes can't connect the dots. I certainly couldn't. And it took me months and months. My heart was racing. That's another common symptom. And I went to a cardiologist. And, you know, then my skin dried out. And I thought, what's going on with my skin? Your skin dries out. Even your ears. Everything dries out. It's nuts. And my dermatologist didn't put it together. And so, and that's very common with women. There's been studies that they spend an average, you know, with co-pays and running around to doctors of sometimes a couple $1,000s because they just don't know what's wrong with them. And the information isn't out there. So yes, it took me a while. And again, it can be hard to tease out if some of the symptoms, like I started not sleeping so well, that can just be midlife, right? Mm-hmm. In midlife, we're often taking care of elderly parents. Sometimes we have kids and they haven't left the nest yet. Often people are working. So, okay, yes, of course you're tired. So sometimes that can be difficult too. But yes, I went to one doctor who said, when I said I had pain during sex, he said to just have a glass of wine. Yoga comes up a lot. They, you know, you get recommended yoga and having a glass of wine. And that is kind of a short-term solution.
And we can do better than that, though. You write there are, for various symptoms and conditions, different treatments out there. Can you talk a little bit about the state of the art when it comes to treating the wide variety of menopause symptoms?
Well, one of my messages in the book is not just, you know, I think there are three things to do. One is to be aware of the symptoms. If you're aware of the symptoms, there are 34, you know, that's kind of what people say. Some doctors I talked to said, oh, there are more than that. But if you know if you are at least aware of the symptoms, and you might not get 34, you might not get three. Some women don't get any. Every expert I talked to said, be sure and tell your readers that some sail through menopause with no symptoms. But if you are aware of the symptoms, then you can connect the dots, which is what I was unable to do. And the other message of the book is that there are solutions out there, which I also didn't know. For almost every symptom, there are multiple remedies. Some are lifestyle, some are medication, some are non-hormonal. There are all kinds of things. If you can just find a practitioner who can point you towards them or study up on what's available, you can kind of feel like yourself again. I did after a while, but it took a while.
Talking to Jancy Dunn about her new book, Hot and Bothered, What No One Tells You About Menopause and How to Feel Like Yourself Again. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have an experience to share, did you talk to someone else about perimenopause or menopause before you got there? Or did it take you by surprise like it does a lot of people? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Lisa is with us in Madison. Lisa, hi.
Well, am I happy you're having this topic? And you just brought up exactly what I want to bring up with perimenopause. I was 42 or 43, and I couldn't understand why my emotions were all over the place. I was still getting my multiples regularly. I wasn't having hot flashes. And doctors were saying, oh, you're depressed, you're anxious. I thought, but I have no reason to be depressed or anxious. What is going on? And I didn't connect the dots for years. And most people think menopause is, it's just about when your periods stop. But there's years before that where there's so much going on. And the other issue that I don't hear people talking about, that a standard of care in Europe is pelvic floor therapy. And that's needed, obviously, after childbirth, which we never get. But it's very, very necessary during menopause, especially if you didn't get it sooner.
Lisa, thanks a lot for the call. Jadzy, what do you think?
She is right about everything. Pelvic floor therapy really does help. And that's one of, you know, there's good data about it. And I have it in the book that that can help with things like incontinence, which is, you know, not the sexiest topic, but it is what often happens. You know, you pee a little bit more when estrogen leaves your body. That usually makes your pelvic floor, the tissue surrounding your reproductive organs, more supple. And so they get dry, your urethra shortens. Who knew? Another thing I didn't know. And so something like pelvic floor therapy can really help. And again, you know, my experience was similar to Lisa's, that, you know, here I was in my 40s. And that's the thing, too, is that menopause is kind of a subject that's easy to stash away. You think, oh, okay, oh, that happens to older people. Oh, that's golden girls, menopause, that's not me. And I remember even I sort of had to confront my own internalized, you know, ageist feelings, because I thought, you know, oh, well, that's for older ladies. I'm not old. Well, I'm getting older. And yes, indeed, I did go through menopause, and it is what it is. And it's, you know, the thing about menopause is you don't go through it and come out the other side. You enter it and you stay there. There's perimenopause, which, as Lisa pointed out, it can last from 4 to 8 years, the symptoms where, you know, you're the hormones are leaving your body. It's kind of like reverse puberty. And it can be as chaotic as puberty, as the hormones are leaving your body. And then you go through menopause, which on average is age 51. And it's when you've gone 12 months without a period. And then you're in postmenopause. So you can be in menopause for 40 years, you know, and I can remember when I first started writing this book, I thought, what other books are out there? I went to my library and there's acres of pregnancy books. If you want to know what to expect when you're expecting, you're covered. It went on and on and on. And then there was, I have a nice library. There was one book on menopause. It was from the 90s and it was dusty and the information there was outdated. And I thought, how can there be so few books on such a major transition in a woman's life? Again, like Bridget Christie said, it affects half the population. And so I'm so happy that you have me on the show and that we're beginning to talk about it. I even 2 years ago when I started writing the book, I would never have imagined that it would enter the conversation like it has now. And it's very encouraging.
Thanks a lot for that call, Lisa. We're talking to journalist and author Jadzy Dunn about her new book. It's called Hot and Bothered, What No One Tells You About Menopause and How to Feel Like Yourself Again. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about what she found in writing this book? Were you caught by surprise with symptoms you experienced yourself? If you're not there yet, has somebody given you the information you think you need to know? Or are you hearing this and thinking, I need to know more? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. The conversation continues coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation about menopause and why we don't talk about it. Here's Academy Award-winning actress Viola Davis talking about it on Jimmy Kimmel Live.
What is menopause? I mean, I've heard of it. I know that it happens.
You know what? Menopause is hell.
It is.
Jimmy.
Is it really?
Menopause is a dark hole. Okay, that's what menopause is. And that's where I'm at right now.
Oh.
So I either will love my husband today or kill him today.
Oh, no. How long does it last?
You know what? Somebody needs to tell me, because it's lasted now for about 6 or 7 years.
We're talking to author Jancy Dunn about her new book, Hot and Bothered, What No One Tells You About Menopause and How to Feel Like Yourself Again. You could join in at 800-642-1234 to share your experience if you're willing, or your questions for our guest about her book. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Angela is with us in Germantown. Angela, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I just wanted to tell you about when I was in my early 30s. It was about 33, 34, and I couldn't sleep. I got the sweats. I couldn't think. I left the stove on. I mean, I was just getting depressed, anxiety, everything. And, of course, they all wanted, the doctors wanted to put me all on anti-anxiety and depression pills and everything. And I said, no, that's not it. There's something going on. And I know that's not it. And 2 years later, I found out through Channel 10 that Christian Northrup, a doctor, she said progesterone cream helps perimenopause. Or premenopause, and I took that, and within 24 hours, I was sleeping. I felt just like myself.
Wow. Angela, thanks a lot for the call. Jancy, the emotional changes that could come along trying to sort out anxiety, depression, or impact of perimenopause, what kind of things did you learn researching your book?
Well, the brain fog that is so common, and I totally hear that caller because I had it too. Brain fog is a really common one. If you're in perimenopause and you are prone to anxiety disorders or depression, you will have it more intently in perimenopause. So if you find out that you have perimenopause, it's good to screen for depression. But the brain fog is very interesting. I interviewed a number of neuroscientists and people who study menopause and the brain. And some good news is that I can remember having brain fog that was so severe, I couldn't remember the word for knife, for butter knife. I was getting enraged, and I was saying to my husband, hand me the shiny thing that spreads butter. Like that's what my communication was down to. And the beautiful thing is your brain fog in most cases goes away after a while, which is, when does that ever happen? When you lose some sort of body or brain function and it comes back? But research shows that it does. And I am feeling much sharper than I did 2 years ago when I was in the midst of it. And in fact, I was wondering how I was even going to talk about this book. But now I seem semi-lucid, I hope, right?
Doing good,
and so
yeah.
That's one good thing about it. And the mood swings are real because, again, it's like having PMS all over again. It's hormonal havoc. And it can be hard to discern, again, what is stress related and what could be something deeper. But yes, and there are all kinds of remedies. There are hormones. There are other things that you can take that are non-hormonal. Tons of them, which I list in my book because there's too many to mention, which is a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot for that call, Angela, talking to Jancy Dunn about the new book, Hot and Bothered, What No One Tells You About Menopause and How to Feel Like Yourself Again. We'll go now to Kristen in Eau Claire. Kristen, hi.
Hi. Thanks for the topic. I just wanted to share the experience that I had where, you know, I brought up to my doctor the impact of pain during intercourse that's come with menopause, and they prescribed me a prescription that was $400 that's not covered by insurance. And I just think there's a lot of unfairness in that if a man were experiencing a condition that inhibited their, sexual life, it's covered by insurance or it's much more affordable.
I gotcha, Kristen. Kristen, seeing Jancy, a bias in the way we cover medications related to menopause.
Oh, Kristen, 100%. I can't tell you how many urologists, OBGYNs that I interviewed in the book that would say that especially for women, quality of life is not paid attention to in medicine. Pain during intercourse affects your quality of life. It affects your relationship with your partner. it's physical pain. I had it too. And that is a problem. And one of my messages in the book is to, yeah, I know in the expense, in terms of the remedies for this sort of thing can just be so awful. And one thing I do say is to, I hope women will give themselves permission if they are having these quality of life issues to seek treatment, because it is real. And if a doctor dismisses your problem, see another doctor. And GoodRx is a good place to go to for coupons for various medications. But yes, I completely agree with her. And I hope that we can all get to the point where we talk about this more, and that it then filters through the culture. And, you know, we're not there in terms of systemic or medical solutions, but the more we talk about this stuff and bring it out in the open, I think the better. I do see a grassroots kind of campaign happening, which makes me feel good. And everybody wants to talk about it. It happens to half the population. I keep saying that, I know, but...
Kristen, thanks a lot for that call. Jancy, something I definitely wanted to get into is you're trying to make sure that we talk about menopause in the first place. You're also talking about how we talk about it. I think you give the example of phrases like, well, you know, after menopause, you could still, you know, be attractive, or you could still be talented or smart or productive. You could still cling on to some of those vestiges of your youth. You're trying to change that, I think, to, hey, this is a valid and possibly positive phase of life. How do we get there?
Yes, I say it over and over. It's not a disease. It's a life transition. I do feel hopeful that younger generations, the examples that they give, like I'm in Generation X, and I feel like the generations that are coming up, they're so transparent about things like menstruation, about body positivity. And I feel like they're going to be much more open about it. And we're starting to as well. I never had a single conversation with my own mother about menopause. And until I started writing this book, and I said, hey, how was your menopause experience? I was just this, you know, annoying teen who just assumed that my mom was crabby all the time. She was having mood disorders, and she was, you know, dripping in meetings because she was a working mom. And the conversation is something we should also have with our partners. I realized that I wasn't telling my husband what was going on with my body. And part of it is this shame, this stigma that I want to break away from. So I just said, you know, here's what's going on in very simple terms. You know, estrogen is leaving my body. We have estrogen receptors in many different parts of our body. And this is how it's being affecting me. And here's what you could do to help me. And I'm sorry, I've been keeping this from you. He's getting older too. We all are, you know, and so my hope is eventually we get to the point where menopause, you just sort of greet it with a shrug instead of, oh, Lord. You know, taking away the surprise of the symptoms, like some of the callers where they didn't know what it was, the shock of it, the misinformation that's out there. If you know what they are and then you know how to treat them and you talk about it with everybody, so it's not this thing that you feel like you need to keep hidden, then we're on our way.
Jancy, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Really, thank you so much for having me and talking about this.
That's Jancy Dunn, a journalist and author. She talked to us about her new book. It's called Hot and Bothered, What No One Tells You About Menopause and How to Feel Like Yourself Again. Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday, and this week, heritage grains and how to use them. A cookbook author tells us about everything from oats, I heard of those, to einkorn, not so familiar, and how to use those grains in our cooking. Get some good advice and check out some recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.